Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. It's 8 minutes after 7, just gone 9 minutes, and this is a special program. Normally we have burning issue in the slot, but we've decided to shift the focus to Al-Aqsa. And on the 21st of August 1969, an extremist Australian Christian, Dennis Michael Rohan, attempted to set fire to Masjid Al-Aqsa Mosque, a significant moment in the history of the sacred mosque. Now, the fire destroyed some of Jerusalem's most historic landmarks, including a thousand-year-old pulpit. It is believed Dennis Rohan's actions had the blessing of the Israeli occupational forces at the time. Some 51 years later, the noble sanctuary of Al-Aqsa remains under as great a threat as ever. So welcome to the special program on Masjid Al-Aqsa, and as we remember this event and look at how it relates to the current events at Al-Aqsa and Palestine, we will highlight the fact that this week marks the launch of a global campaign initiated by the Mimba Al-Aqsa Forum, which is scheduled to begin on the 21st of August. Our guest this evening in the simulcast will be Maulana Yusuf Patel, Secretary General of United Ulama Council of South Africa, Dr. Anwar Nagia, a member of the Mimba Al-Aqsa Forum, Friends of Palestine founder Ismail Adam Patel, and Hafid Ibrahim Musa from the Palestine Information Network. And we'll also be joined in a moment by Sheikh Ibrahim Gabriels, who is the Director of the Al-Quds Foundation, and also he is a board member on the Mimba Al-Aqsa Forum as well, as we engage with this matter. And I think also it's prudent for us to mention at the offset that this becomes even more topical right now because of the political situation happening inside Jerusalem, the relations between the United States and Israel, and most recently UAE stepping out of the shadows and kind of entrenching the relationship with the Zionist State of Israel, and people asking questions, what does that mean? So I think that this will be a very broad discussion, but focused on the theme of, yes, the burning of the Mimbar as a physical but also ideological act, in a sense. And I do believe we have online with us now Sheikh Ibrahim Gabriels, Director of the Al-Quds Foundation. Sheikh, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and all our dear listeners, and Honorable Maulana Yusuf Patel, and Honorable Dr. Anwar Nagia, Honorable Brother Ismail Patel, and Hafiz Ibrahim Musa. It's a sad moment, or it was a sad moment, 51 years, and every year at this time, it's a sad moment. And we thank Voice of the Cape and all the other radios and media for allowing us to speak to our community and to the people of the world, not only Muslims. And you know, when you spoke about this and you mentioned the name Dennis Michael Rohan, Brother Vasih, I couldn't help to think about our honorable former president of the MGC and former director of Al-Quds Foundation, Maulana Ihsan Hendricks, may Allah grant him Jannah to Firdaus. Because, I mean, Maulana always spoke about this name. I mean, some people just say Michael Rohan, but Maulana preferred to say Dennis Michael Rohan. And yes, on the 21st of August, 1969, just imagine attempting to burn the Masjid Al-Aqsa, la ilaha illallah. So this is a crucial moment for all of us, for the Muslims especially, but for all the people in the world, because Masjid Al-Aqsa is the first Qibla of the Muslim Ummah. And Sheikh Raed Salah, that takes a lead and is called the Sheikh Al-Aqsa of the world. You know, he's been locked up again for 17 months. And we saw the video when he went to his mother to greet his mother, and he said, "Mother, don't worry, it's only going to be a few days." That is the spirit of the people of Palestine and the Sheikh Al-Aqsa. And he always used to tell us and the world, Al-Aqsa fi khatr. Masjid Al-Aqsa is in danger, because that was 51 years ago, but it didn't stop. The burning continues. So what Sheikh Raed Salah is actually telling the people, the Muslims of the world, is that how can you sit back and people are trying to burn and to destroy Masjid Al-Aqsa? So I know my time is limited, Brother Vasih, but on behalf of Al-Quds Foundation from South Africa and Al-Quds Foundation International, we give our full support, and we ask everybody this week to concentrate. And in fact, the request is this Jumu'ah, Every imam should be the focus on Masjid Al-Aqsa. Jazakumullah khairan and may Allah grant the program to be a great success. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. That of course being Sheikh Ibrahim Gabriel's and we are engaging on the matter of 51 years later and the blaze continues. That's the discussion talking about the burning of the minbar of Salahuddin Ayyubi in 1969 and how those events fit into an entire narrative that still plays itself out in the lands of Palestine. And of course, this program is a simulcast with Voice of the Cape, CII Radio, Salaam Media, and Al Ansar, and those the audiences are all tuned into this discussion this evening. I want to welcome my other two guests in studio with me, Dr. Anwar Nagia, member of Al Aqsa Forum member, and then also online we have Mona Yusuf Patel from United Ulama Council of South Africa. Gentlemen, assalamu alaikum. Now, I know that United Ulama Council of South Africa has most recently released a statement Mona Yusuf, had kind of just sketch the significance of this 1960, this incident of 1969. Just pivotal to that, if we go back 2 years to 1967, where we see the seizure of Al-Aqsa taking place. So in your mind, if you kind of put the two together, does this seem like a coincidence? Or does it seem as if there was some sort of chess move taking place at that time?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh to my colleagues on the panel and to the listeners across South Africa. Yes, I think in your introduction you've referred to Dennis Michael Rohan, who attempted to set fire to the Masjid al-Aqsa, and as you've correctly pointed out, that 51 years later, the threat against the noble sanctuary of Aqsa continues. And therefore, whatever happens, I don't think happens coincidentally. It's part of a bigger and broader agenda. We must understand that various movements within the Zionist Israel or occupied Palestine are committed to see the ultimate destruction of the Masjid al-Aqsa sanctuary, and they wait in anticipation to build what they regard as the Jewish temple in its place. So in my view, this is all part of a bigger, broader agenda. It's certainly not coincidental that there have been several attempts over the past years aimed at the destruction of Masjid al-Aqsa.
Now, latched onto that, Mona Yusuf, it begs the other question, because we're talking about an Australian national, Dennis Michael Rohan, who was Christian, and he claims to have been inspired by God to, you know, carry out this action in Masjid al-Aqsa. Now, the question would be, why would a Christian insert himself in a narrative that has been a conflict between the Jewish and the Islamic world? Why would a Christian insert himself in this narrative?
I think his actions were motivated by an ideology that is found within the broader Christian community. And that is aptly called Christian Zionism. And Christian Zionists believe that they have a biblical obligation to support the state of Israel. The belief stems from the idea that God promised the land of Israel to the Jews, who will rule it until Jesus returns, may peace be upon him, to Jerusalem. Hence, their support for Israel is equated to support for the return of Prophet Jesus, may peace be upon him. They believe that Israel is outlined in the scripture, belongs exclusively to the Jewish people. Therefore, the land must be taken away from the Palestinians. Palestinians should be driven away from their homes, and the illegal Jewish settlements should expand and keep growing. So they aver that the founding of the State of Israel in 1948 and the capture of Jerusalem in 1967 were the miraculous fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham that he would establish a Jewish nation forever in Palestine. And this belief is so widespread that at least one in four American Christians that were surveyed by Christianity Today, which is a magazine, said they believe that it is their biblical responsibility to support the nation of Israel. So, the Rohan's actions were very much motivated by his belief that supporting Zionism is actually supporting the return of the Prophet Jesus. So Christian Zionism's fusion of religion with politics works to guarantee Israeli interests. It is a political theology based on the belief that Israel is not like any other country. It is part of God's plan foretold in the scripture. Hence, they would do everything or anything required to ensure that the Temple of Solomon is built on the Aqsa Sanctuary, which would then herald the coming of Jesus.
Now, I just to put into context, because we're speaking about the Mimbar of Salahuddin Ayyubi, and a lot of people would ask the question, well, it's just a Mimbar. You know, what is the significance of this? Yes, there was damage done to the masjid, but this central piece, what is its meaning, and what is the reason that there is such great significance placed in this Mimbar? So, Dr. Nagia, if we look at the Mimbar and the role that it played and what it represented, can you just maybe expand on that? And why the destruction of this Mimbar by this Australian national Dennis Michael Rohan, in a sense, set the scene both for, physically, but also in a sense from a political standpoint, a political narrative for what would follow in the decades thereafter, which continues in 2020.
Yeah, shukran. Assalamu alaikum to our brother Yusuf and also to Mulanai, to Sheikh Ibrahim Gabriels, to the listeners and to all the panelists this evening. Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Yes, thanks for having us. We really appreciate it. I represent as well the Palestine Museum. Your point is well made in the sense that we have to understand the significance of the position of a mimbar. Now, most people understand, Muslims particularly, when they go to mosque, when they in prayer, in Jummah, in great events on the Islamic calendars, many of the direction of the Muslims comes from the pulpit or from a mimbar, from the sheikhs and all of the learned scholars. But more particularly, the mimbar of Al-Quds, Al-Aqsa Mosque, Al-Quds is basically the name for Jerusalem. But Al-Aqsa, the Minbar, was an important part after its liberation by Salah ad-Din Ayyubi. Now, the city of Jerusalem, the city of Al-Quds, many, many centuries ago, more than 600 years, the Muslims, or at the time, were not Muslim, because Islam is only 1400 years ago, but you had the Byzantine Christians and you had the Jews, which came literally from as scattered people from Egypt, and then during the Canaan period were Canaanites and entered Jerusalem, not as a big grouping, and entered the Quds area, or Al-Quds. Al-Aqsa was built before that, during that period as well, and it became the first Qibla for Muslims. Now, naturally, the Mimbar of Al-Quds represented the direction, not only for Muslims, but also the political, religious, and spiritual ideological position. And therefore, the Mimbar was an important, significant feature. And Salah ad-Din Ayyubi not only liberated Al-Quds, but also built and finished that Mimbar, which was actually built in Syria. And if you understand that particular Mimbar, that pulpit or that mihrab, it was built by hand, and not a single nail was used to build the many, many thousands of pieces that's puzzled together. You can actually fill two rugby fields of the little joints and disjoints, and people don't know this. It was recently obviously restored back to its rightful place. Almost in the similar vein, it was constructed. Now, Michael Rohan was not placed there just as a tourist, as an Australian Christian Zionist, correctly as Brother Yusuf has said. We can't believe that he had the abilities and capabilities, understanding after the 67 period, or the 67 war that took place, the Six-Day War in 1967, where many of the territories was captured post the Nakba period of 1948, when the Zionist project in fact became a state by the United Nations. And we must remember that also in 1948, the apartheid state of South Africa was also given credence by the same United Nations. The same United Nations who adopted just later that year the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which in fact goes contrary to the fact that they accepted two illegitimate states that took place, both in Israel, which is occupied Palestine, and of course South Africa. And these two states was always in cahoots with the development programs. But coming back to the Mimbar, so the importance of the seat of Muslim power, of the seat of Islamic direction, in fact took a particular position when Al-Aqsa was then occupied. It was occupied not only by a Zionist project, but it was always occupied by both the British, which originally was a British mandate from 1917, when the Balfour Declaration was there, Palestinian lands, when we saw the collapse of the Ottoman Empire, or the demise of the Ottoman Empire, the Al-Aqsa became under threat already from what we call the 1917 Balfour Declaration. And it was important to dislodge the Muslims, and it was important to dislodge probably the best icon of Muslims was the first Qibla, Al-Aqsa. And of course the Mimbar, the seat of power, the where sermons are given from, to destroy that. So Michael Rohan was then declared first an insane person. He was regarded as a person that wasn't normal. A normal person could burn almost three quarters of Al-Aqsa, could burn not only the 1,000-year Mimbar, which was constructed by hundreds of artisans in Syria, and also, you know, under no protection. The mosque was left on that day. The fire services couldn't come. They all of a sudden came 3 hours late. There was no assistance to help the destruction of the Mimbar and the mosque. So there was a what we call a conspiratorial approach to destroying the member of Al-Aqsa.
And if we look at the evidence presented by the Palestinian authorities around this incident, that people are saying, well, you know, this man was a crazy person and he did it.
He was released because he was crazy.
The reality of the matter is that at that time, I mean, just after 2 years after capturing Al-Aqsa, after that, the war that we mentioned, we found a situation where the compound of Al-Aqsa was under occupation, and yet a man which he claimed large amounts of flammable material, was able to pass through checkpoints. There are checkpoints all around the compound. He was able to pass through with this flammable material, and it is said that the fires were lit 200 meters apart.
Apart, yes. Yeah, if you look at what happened, both they admitted, obviously, if you look at what they call the fire forensics, that took the forensics about the issues around how the blaze was started, it was exactly as you said, it was at two different points, and with the same intensity, with a view to burn it down. But let me just come back to another point, and it has some correlation.
I think we'll go back to that point in a moment, inshallah. We're just going to take the adhan for the Waqt of Isha. We'll be back immediately thereafter. Mona Yusuf Patel, please do stay with us as we engage on this matter further. Of course, this is Symbolcast. Tonight, we are joined by CII Radio, Salaam Media, as well as the audiences of Radio Al-Ansar. And of course, this is live on 91.3 FM, the Voice of the Cape. We're talking about 51 years later, the inferno continues to blaze. The burning of the member of Salahuddin Ayyubi by an extremist Australian Christian, Dennis Michael Rohan. And tonight we're talking about the effects that had from political a viewpoint, from a social viewpoint in Palestine, and how the dynamics shifted even more to the point where we find ourselves now in 2020. We'll be back after this. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome back. It's 7:37, and we continue our discussion around the 51-year anniversary of the burning of the minbar of Salahuddin Ayyubi, and we're looking at the broader context and of what Palestine is today, what the issue of the Palestinian liberation movement has been, and also we're asking the question in terms of this 51-year period, how much do we really understand around the importance of the Palestinian issue and the link between the Zionist State of Israel and South Africans, and the history of South Africa, and how closely these two are linked. Our guest this evening for this part of the show, Mona Yusuf Patel from United Ulama Council of South Africa, still online with us. And then we have Dr. Anwar Nagia, who is on the Minbar Al-Aqsa Forum. And I just want to go back to Mona Yusuf quickly on the line and ask the question. So if we look at kind of the inhumanity suffered by Palestinians at checkpoints, etc., it does seem to be that they are treated as inferior human beings. Now, first of all, the one part of my question is this racism informed by some kind of religious belief? That's the one thing. But the other thing also is, in relation to this kind of racism, can we say that, you know, we can draw those parallels between racism in occupied Palestine and racism in apartheid South Africa on that level?
It is interesting to note that the three major religious communities, that is Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all claim to be the children of Nabi Ibrahim alayhi salatu wasalam. But what each of the three faiths derive from the allegiance to Nabi Ibrahim is very, very different. The Jews believe that by virtue of the lineage to Ibrahim, alayhi salatu wasalam, they are the chosen people, the children of Ibrahim, and because they were the chosen children of Ibrahim, prophethood was a privilege granted only to them. If you look at Christianity, Christians, on the other hand, believe that Nabi Isa alayhi salatu wasalam is also or was also a descendant of Nabi Ibrahim, who graciously paid for the sins of humanity by giving up his life. So the Jews derived from Ibrahim racial superiority. And the Quran speaks about their sense of racial superiority in the following word, نَحْنُ أَبْنَاءُ اللَّهِ وَأَحِبَّاءُ. We are the sons of Allah and are his loved ones. The Christians, on the other hand, derived the concept of divine atonement from him. But we as Muslims derive from our link to Nabi Ibrahim alayhi salatu wasalam the belief or the notion of unreserved submission. Now, if all three faiths connect to a single prophet, that is Nabi Ibrahim, why then do we have such brutality displayed by cousins, or rather, to be more specific, by the Zionists towards Muslims in Palestine? And to understand this, we need to go back into history. The Jews and the Christians are the children of Nabi Ishaq. So Nabi Ibrahim alayhi salatu wasalam had two sons, Ishaq and Ismail. And from Ishaq came Yaqub alayhi salatu wasalam, and from Yaqub came Yusuf, and then the Banu Israel, from Musa alayhi salam, and then Isa alayhi salatu wasalam. So that's the lineage coming down from Nabi Ishaq alayhi salatu wasalam. And the Muslims, however, are connected to Nabi Ismail, whose mother was Hajra radiallahu anha. The Jews believe that Nabi Ibrahim, al-ayyad billah, had an illegitimate relationship with the slave girl of Sarah, that is Hajra, and hence Arabs are therefore, the illegitimate tribe that came down from the slave girl Hajra. And as a result, they believe that, the Arabs as such are this illegitimate children of a slave girl. And based on this, they believe that they've been exempted from all kind of moral responsibility towards an illegitimate nation. And a verse in the Quran speaks to this, where Allah says, وَمِنْ أَهْلِ الْكِتَابِ, and from among the people or the followers of earlier revelation, are many. If you entrust them بِقِنْطَارٍ, with a treasure, they will faithfully restore it. In other words, there are people from earlier revelations who are absolutely honest, absolutely just and upright. But then the verse goes on to say, وَمِنْهُمْ, and there is among them, that if you entrust them with a single coin, they will not restore it until you keep standing over them. In other words, you have to keep fighting for your rights. Which is, and this attitude, the Quran says, is an outcome of the assertion that no blame can attach to us for anything that we may do with regard to these unlettered folk. So yes, you know, their treatment and how they view the Palestinians in particular and Arabs in general is that these are lesser human beings and children of slaves, illegitimate children of slaves, and hence they owe no moral responsibility to such a nation. And that is evident and demonstrated in the way they treat our Palestinian brethren in Masjid al-Aqsa and in Quds.
The voice of Mona Yusuf Patel of United Ulama Council of South Africa. And we also have in studio with us Dr. Anwar Nagia. We're engaging on the burning of the mimbar of Salahuddin Ayyubi 51 years ago. This broadcast is held in partnership with CII, Radio Islam. So we welcome the audiences as well as Sana Media this evening. And As we continue this discussion, and I think that we've got to also shift towards contemporary issues, because it's important for us to understand the history, but there have been some shifts most recently, some significant shifts. One of those, Dr. Nagia, has been the determination of the Trump administration to move the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem. And we've also seen UAE normalizing relations with Israel. So what does this do? How does this impact the Palestinian narrative? Does it in any way undermine peace in the region as well?
Yeah, I think, first of all, I want to just step back. Judaism and Zionism are diametrically opposed. The connection and the broad-based popular view is that Judaism is synonymous with Zionism. Zionism is a political ideology. Judaism is a religion. It has its own momentum, and exactly as our brother Yusuf, Sheikh Yusuf and Patel, has articulated in terms of lineage and in terms of what are the outcomes and why, to an extent, the forms of racism as you see them in the contemporary discourse has manifested itself. But Zionism literally started, or the Zionist project started in about 1890s by Theodore Herzl, who wanted to get a kind of a peaceful settlement for a Jewish homeland somewhere in the world. It was in Palestine. It was either going to be Uganda or someplace in Latin America. And then, of course, through their manipulation of Lord Balfour, because Palestine was a British mandate at the time, and one must understand the collapse and the demise of the Ottoman period, in fact, gave Britain lots of rights over that particular territories, as it were. And that, in fact, narrative became a kind of religious discourse which Zionism pushed into a way that it manipulated itself as if Zionism is a religion. Zionism is not Judaism. Zionism is not a religion. It's a political and racist political ideology as it manifests itself in today's contemporary terms. So I just want to kind of put that out there, and because that's the position. Lots of Jewish people do not support Zionists. And the Christian Zionists in America, or the Judeo-Christians in America, is a large percentage of people that actually believe in the narrative as if Zionism, the Zionism that you're seeing today, is the Zionist land or the Holy Land which they aspire to come from and the descendants of Christ.
If I can maybe just insert this comment in there, because we're talking about Theodor Herzl and as the architect or the father of Zionism, and we're saying that these two concepts are diametrically opposed, Zionism and Judaism. And even if we look in the life of Theodor Herzl, his only son, Hans, was given a secular upbringing, and Herzl notably refused to allow him to be circumcised, so which is a tenet in the Jewish faith. So what we're seeing here is it's not necessarily this understanding that it is Judaism versus Islam, or that the matter is one of being anti-Semitic, but rather the political view around statehood is the issue, and the fact that the what makes this even more clear is the whole the Zionist movement itself was started by someone who didn't necessarily according
absolutely.
To the text.
I mean, he was a journalist.
Yes,
he was a journalist that in fact saw persecution of Jews.
Yes,
both in the rise of nationalism in Europe and the persecution of Jews everywhere in the world, and that's how the Zionist project actually started. It was a political an ideological position and not so informed by a religious discourse on protecting the Jewish people for a homeland. And as I say, Uganda was one. I think it was Brazil or part of Brazil in Latin America. And then, of course, the fortuitous nature of the British and under the Balfour Declaration, in fact, gave the Jewish homeland, because many, many of the persecuted Jews, the Ashkenazi Jews, were persecuted in Europe, and they found a good home, a very good home, and the Palestinians embraced them and took them in as refugees, and didn't know that not only were they going to be parasitic. In fact, by 48, they were armed by the British, they were armed by the Americans, and already in 47 and others, the blueprints was there, and of course, the great Nakba, and the expelling of over 7 million Palestinians, of which 7 million lives in exile, and another 9 million lives in Palestine, in probably occupying only 15% of the land. So this has been the kind of contradiction in terms of the two kind of contestations. You know, this is not, the Palestinians are not in contestations with Jewish people. The Palestinians are in contestation with a Zionist occupier, with a occupying colonial force, aided and abetted by the U.S. Now, since the Tel Aviv move of the embassy to Jerusalem, and then Trump declaring that Jerusalem is the capital of the Jewish people, not saying it's the capital of Israel, but it's the capital of the Jewish people. Confused as he might be, it was part informing his power base and keeping himself more in power to make a kind of statement that would appease the Judeo-Christian Zionists in America. And very similar mistakes was made by our Chief Justice, which made the same connection, which referred to the state of Israel or the Israelites as if they're the contemporary Israelites. The Bible or the Torah can't be speaking of the same murders, the same occupation, the same land seizures, the different roads that's being built, one for settlers and the others for Palestinians, the 500 checkpoints just in Jerusalem itself, you know, the new annexation of another 55,000 hectares of land in Area C, which has been taken over by force, even though the UAE perceives that they've stopped annexation in return for normalizations of the Arab states against the kind of legitimacy of the state of Israel. It's not going to happen. It hasn't happened. In fact, it's caused a much bigger divide in the contemporary issues. Just yesterday, many, many Palestinians were injured, like they are injured and murdered and maimed every single day in the whole of occupied Palestine. The blockage of Gaza that just took place since 2014, and also recently bombing the last few days. holding and capturing and enslaving 2 million people, water, schools, sanitations, electricity, every aspect of people's lives, terrorizing young children, arresting kids that are underage, on the age of 8, 6, 7. This takes place daily. Their schools, their parents being traumatized, their mothers give birth at checkpoints, their mothers die at checkpoints, COVID hospitals have been destroyed. Is this the same kind of Israel the Torah or the Bible speaks of? Is this the same kind of society which our Chief Justice would want to pray for? And anybody who do not support the state of Israel will be cursed, and he'll be cursed as a Christian? I don't believe that many Christians endorse that same viewpoint. And this is the narrative which Trump is using. I couldn't care who's president of America. Their foreign policy towards occupied Palestine is exactly the same. Whether it is Biden and whether it's this right-wing,
Kamala Harris.
I mean, she's obviously told AIPAC exactly her allegiance towards the illegitimate state of Israel and how the American government should support it. Now, we can't fall for this trap. We can't fall for this trap that the Zionist movement is actually a religious movement. They come in peace. They come with the word of God, the word of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. They come with the word of the blessings of peace. It's not informed by that. It's informed by a different kind of narrative. And so we must not confuse people all the time where they want to use Zionism as a form of a religious discourse. It's not at all. And then also the debate about, you know, if you anti-Zionism, you anti-Jew, which is basically Semitic or anti-Semitic. Anti-Semitism has got nothing to do with your hatred for Jewish people. It's your hatred for Arabs, for all people that come from the Semite region, the old region, and this nonsense that the word anti-Semitism is the prerogative of being anti-Jewish community. It's just not so.
So we're saying that when we talk about Semites, we're not talking about an ethnic group in a sense, but we're talking about a geographical...
Yes, particularly that entire region.
Okay. If we look at this, and I just want to look at some of the incidences that have occurred. We've spoken about the 1969 burning of the Mimbar by Dennis Michael Rohan, but also notably 1990, the first Aqsa massacre, which took place, claiming the lives of 21 worshippers and 150 wounded after a group of settlers attempted to lay the foundation stone to build the temple. Also in 1990, on the 23rd of September, the second Al-Aqsa massacre, known as the Tunnel Intifada, where 51 Palestinians were killed and 300 injured after the occupation forces opened fire on worshippers in Al-Aqsa following the announcement of the opening of a tunnel adjacent to the Barak wall of the mosque. Then in September of 2000, soon to be elected Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon stormed Masjid Al-Aqsa under the guard of hundreds of occupation soldiers, sparking the Al-Aqsa Intifada. And then, of course, also numerous plots have been reported to burn or blow up Masjid Al-Aqsa over the decades, employing military might to shoot and injure worshippers, and seeking to install metal detectors at the entrances of Masjid al-Aqsa in 2017, which led to the closure of Masjid al-Aqsa in that period of time. Eventually the metal detectors were removed. But what would you say, Mona Yusuf, was the particularly with this last incident in 2017, was the broader agenda around installing metal detectors? Because someone could so easily say, well, you know, metal detectors keeps everyone safe. So what was the reason behind this and setting up cameras and, monitoring worshippers going to mosque? Mona Yusuf? I don't know if we... Yeah, I think Mona Yusuf is back with us. Mona, are you able to hear me?
I'm sorry, yes. Unfortunately, I have to take the leave. I did indicate that I'll be with you for an hour. I beg your indulgence. I didn't quite get your last comments, but before I leave, maybe I could take the opportunity just expressing a view on the UAE and Israeli relations.
Mm-hmm.
I think the so-called Abraham Accord is, in fact, a betrayal not only of the Palestinian cause, but a blow to the global Muslim Ummah, and is tantamount to the abandonment of the defense of Masjid al-Aqsa. So in the final analysis, no supporter of Palestine can truly justify maintaining normalized relations with this Zionist entity, given the state-sponsored terrorist activities, given the illegal occupation, and given the further annexation plan. We pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala turns the table in favor of the Muslim Ummah. And jazakallah and salamu alaykum to you, to our esteemed panelists, and to the listeners.
Mona Yusuf, thank you so much for joining us this evening. That, of course, being Mona Yusuf Patel from United Ulama Council of South Africa. Weighing in on the 51-year commemoration of the burning of the Minbar of Salahuddin Ayyubi. Mona, all the best, inshallah. Shukran so much, and we'll chat soon, perhaps again, inshallah. Well, of course, while we are discussing that, perhaps, Dr. Nagy, you would maybe like to take a crack at that particular question. I think the fact that we find ourselves, if I can frame it in my question in this way, we find ourselves in a situation right now where this issue of Palestine is portrayed one way in mainstream media. And we hear another narrative coming through from other sources, from Palestinians themselves, social media. There's definitely a split in how things are being reported. And one of those ways would be, and one of the things that might be ambiguous is when we hear Palestinians are being opposed to metal detectors and cameras being installed on Masjid al-Aqsa, when people say, well, these things, we trust them because they keep us safe. What is your view around, the intention behind installing these security devices, quote unquote, and how we should be looking at the intention for this kind of monitoring of the compound of Al-Aqsa?
Yeah. So the decision of the Mufti of Al-Aqsa at the time in 2017, when the installation of almost every aspect of every road leading up to Al-Aqsa Mosque, the compound, Dome of the Rock, from north, south, east, and west, and also aerial photographs. It was all in preparation for the annexation. All of this was done as a precursor to the annexation, full knowing that they already have partial control of the West Bank, and they were going to complete it by now saying that Muslims can worship, firstly, on their terms. Already it's very difficult for any person under 55 on certain days to actually perform their religious obligations there, and more so during the Jummah prayer. And you find many of the youth having to salah outside of the walls of Al-Aqsa. So that was a precursor. But remember, it's also a sanctuary, a holy sanctuary, and also part of UNESCO's position with regard to the international protection of places of worship and heritage that has a that has a symbolism for all of humanity. It's not only for Muslims, it's important for Muslims, but not only for Muslims, many places of sanctuary in terms of UNESCO. And even UNESCO was condemning the putting up of security apparatus, profiling, high-tech cameras to look at the movements of Palestinians, not to damage, because no Palestinian, not in his right or left mind, or right or left brain, will go there to damage other than to protect Al-Aqsa. So it was a fallacy to believe that. It was preparing Al-Aqsa for the annexation. It was preparing Al-Aqsa for this complete takeover of Judaizing the whole of the discourse in Jerusalem, the Al-Quds. And that was the reason. And of course, many of the Muslims, in fact, all of them, listened to the Mufti of Al-Quds, saying that we will not make Salah there then. We will make Salah outside of the precincts of the holy, of the holy, of the holy city. And day after day after day, you know, that strategy worked. And they then eventually removed all of the cameras, all of the high tech, and of course the, what they call the scanners as you go through these gates. Particularly, as you say, it's a precursor. And now we know what it was for. It was for the annexation plans, which has taken place. And of course, I agree with our brother Yusuf, in terms of the UAE that have abandoned, that have horse traded with the rights of Muslims to something which is theirs inherently for centuries, and to in fact trade that off for normalization of a illegitimate state, a rogue state, a state-sponsored killings, Mossad agents killing people even in the UAE not too long ago under the guise of Australian passports on territories within hotels in the UAE. Now, we know that it's pressure for the Trump campaign and for the Netanyahu campaign. Both these individuals are not only fighting for their lives, but both these individuals are being charged criminally for a number of other events. Besides Trump's impeachment case, there's dozens of other cases that's lodged against Trump. And we know now for the first time Netanyahu was brought before a court in occupied territory in Israel. And that case is probably going to run for a few years. They have a split government, so Gantz will be head of the military, and Netanyahu would be prime minister or president, and they will switch roles. You know, in the interim, it is to appease the elections staring down Trump's face, which is a few months away, 2 or 3 months away. And they needed something very big. So Kushner, Jared Kushner, just went on the news the other day to say, do you know what normalization means now, that the Muslims can come from all over the world to actually ziyarat, to come and pray at their holy site and at their holy place. Making a Freudian slip in his statement, you know. He didn't say at the Jewish Temple Mount, but at the Muslims' holy site. If you listen to his words, and he's obviously not going to be forgiven by Zionist lobby for his choice of words.
Just on that, because obviously with the annexation taking place, it brings about the whole question that has been floated in discussions. I mean, going back as far as Bill Clinton and Yasser Arafat, the question of the one or two state solution, and which one do you support? In the context or the grander scheme of things, in getting to a point of, I would say, normalization within Palestine, building a relationship between Palestinians and Jews, what would you or Israelis? What would you say out of those two options that, you know, have been floated as solutions to a political and social problem? What would you say would be the most effective?
Ironically, the Zionist occupiers of occupied Palestine never ever believed in a two-state solution. Ever, ever. Capish? That's the simple answer. The long answer is that since the Oslo Accord signed by Yasser Arafat, not a single millimeter of land since the 67 borders was ever going to be given to Palestinians. Even in a two-state solutions. The reality on the day now that there can never ever be a two-state solution, because there's nothing left of occupied Palestine. the settler community has been building, particularly in Jerusalem, over 700,000 new settlements, taken away all of the land which was agreed to in the 67-day period. The Palestinians themselves do not believe in a two-state solution, nor did South Africa believe in a nine-state solution, because we had nine homelands. So we incorporated in one unitary state all of the nine homelands into one unitary state. Nobody yearned for a litigious state to be cut or carved out. And secondly, the deal of the, what they call the century, and we call it the deal of the cemetery, in fact gives no legitimacy to Palestinians. They've been given on a drip feed basis $50 billion, of which only $20 billion or $27 billion they might or might not get. The other balance of the money they might get if they behave. So there can be no military, there can be no airport, there can be no single port, there can be nothing in a so-called free Palestinian state. And secondly, there should be no argument made that the Palestinians must fight for determination. The Palestinians existed there. It was Zionist occupiers who came there as guests to their state. A people without a land came to take away a people with a land. And this, ironically, is the conundrum which people can't understand. There is no such thing as a two-state solution.
And ironically, if we look at that, within Congress, and this has been the mantra of most, political figures who've come to prominence in the United States, particularly in Congress, saying that Israel deserves to exist, and no one denies that. But it almost seems to have been that while the statement is being made, the right of the Palestinian to exist has diminished tremendously, to the point now where they are people without a land from a legal point of view. Globally, they are people without a shrinking heritage, in a sense, and an identity that's becoming obscured. I mean, one of the most recent things, in actual fact, this is not really recent, but Palestine has been wiped off Google Maps.
Yes, since. That's right.
So, I mean, for the new generation who uses Google Maps and, you know, might just somehow end up on that part of the world, they won't see Palestine.
You won't. The U.S. State Department already, as way back at 2018, removed off the topography and typography all the issues around naming of Palestinian cities and remnants of the Palestinian territories as they existed. That instructions was given already, and so did Google and different cartographies and typographers. In fact, just removed the Palestinian history. So we, as human beings, have to understand that the largest places where people are facing what they call complete expulsion is Palestine. That's why that narrative is the biggest one amongst all progressive and free-loving human beings, that we don't say that that Israel has a place. There should be no place for Israel. There should just be one state, a Palestinian state, which can assimilate everybody that stays in Palestine. Whether you're a Jew, whether you're a believer, non-believer, whatever, all of those persons can stay in Palestine, in one free Palestine, like in South Africa. It doesn't matter what persuasion you had, whether you were Xhosa, Sotho, Zulu, black, white, Indian, whatever you called yourself. You're in one South African single unitary state and not in a secular in a divided state, which is given the expression to now with regard to forming a two-state solutions. That doesn't exist, and it cannot exist, and that narrative is pushed all the time by trying to find research that will give the Zionist occupiers a legitimacy, A, for the land, and B, that people actually want it. They don't want it. Both Jewish communities, Christian communities, and Muslim communities want a single unitary Palestinian state. They do want it. They don't want a Zionist occupier to do it. I can tell you We can name rabbis that are in support of a unitary state.
We are now joined online by a founder of Friends of Palestine, Ismail Kutal, who joins us. I want to say welcome into the discussion. Assalamu alaikum, sir.
Wa alaikum salam and assalamu alaikum to all your listeners as well.
It's a pleasure having you with us this evening, sir. And speaking about Al-Aqsa 51 years after the burning of the minbar of Salahuddin Ayyubi, and this seems to have signified, obviously, let's not forget about the Nakba of 1948, but this touching at the heart of the Palestinian, cause, the preservation of Al-Aqsa and the significance that it plays in the roles of Palestinian Muslims globally. What would you say from your perspective has this done for not necessarily the morale of the Palestinians, but in terms of how it in a sense alludes to the greater issue of not only the annexation that we've been speaking about, but a sense of Palestine slipping through our fingers. We've heard Sheikh Raed Salah saying on numerous occasions that Al-Aqsa is in danger. So how does that speak into the narrative 51 years on?
Sure. I mean, the minbar is obviously a great symbolic image for Muslims, and it's a metaphor for the Palestinian occupation as well. I mean, being in the front of the masjid, the person who ascends the minbar has great reverence within the community. And the minbar itself is a symbolic of Muslims and everything we believe in. So the idea of the minbar of Salahuddin, of course, has a great resonance. And as I mentioned, it has also got the impact of what happened in 1969 as a metaphor for the whole Palestinian tragedy. Here was an Australian individual who is pro-Zionist but not Jewish himself, brought to Israel to be studying in the kibbutz through Jewish agencies, and then he's given access to Masjid al-Aqsa who then burns the masjid and the minbar itself. While the Palestinians who are trying to put the fire out were not able to do that, first they were obstructed by the Israeli guards outside the masjid. Once they managed to break that through, they found that they couldn't get the water. And then when they tried to get the fire engines from the West Bank, the Israeli authorities wouldn't allow Palestinian fire engines into the masjid itself. So the fire took a whole 24 hours, in which time the minbar and the whole southern wing of the masjid was burnt down. So that's the metaphor we have here, that while Israel sometimes takes it backstage, it allows others to wreak havoc upon the Palestinians and then says, you know, it's not our fault. And we have seen this repeated over and over again. But the idea of the minbar itself brings life and resonance to the Palestinian struggle and an understanding that this issue brings about the whole global Muslim community, that brings about the human rights violations against the Palestinians and the tragedy that has been facing them since the Nakba, as you mentioned earlier. So it is very, very significant. The idea of the minbar is very important for us. And it's very important for our community and the listeners to understand why the Palestinians want us to revive and understand the significance of the minbar and the burning of the minbar itself.
Now, if we look at the current context we see that Palestine has become, in a sense, a metaphor to a large degree for the descent, I think, within Muslim communities, one of those being the fact that we have UAE as a Arab political force or player in the Arab world, coming along and saying, let's normalize relations with Israel. How does that, in your opinion, change the perspectives in the Arab world, or in a sense, how does that affect the Palestinian cause as a whole when we see UAE coming to the discussion with an idea to normalize the relations with Israel at a time where Palestinians don't have the right to self-determination?
Let's put it in the perspective and in the context we're having this discussion today regarding the minbar itself. Now, let's remind ourselves that the minbar was commissioned by Nuruddin Zinghi, in 1167. At that time, in 1167, Jerusalem was occupied by the Crusaders. And the reason the Crusaders were successful in 1167 to have Masjid al-Aqsa in their possession was because of pliant leaders or Arabs around the region who were supporting the Crusaders. And here was one leader who stood out against the mood of the people. So we have a very similar parallel. I'm not saying it's the same, but we have to think it of in that context, that it only takes one individual's vision and his commitment and then bringing the forces together for the liberation and justice of other people in the hands of Nuruddin. So what UAE is doing is nothing new for us. Unfortunately, the success of the Crusaders was based on the fact that the Arabs, leaders of the time, supported the Crusaders to take over Jerusalem. Otherwise, you know, a few hundred Crusaders from Europe wouldn't have been successful to overcome millions of indigenous Palestinians and Muslim and Christian population of the region. It was only possible because of the traitors of the time. We have a very similar situation now, wherein we have UAE complying with Israel and trying to undermine the human rights, international law, and the legitimacy of the Palestinian people. That obviously is extremely painful. It changes the dynamics temporarily. But that doesn't mean that simply because UAE has decided, which it was doing privately anyway, to go public with Israel, of its relationship, doesn't mean that the situation, we should put up our hands and say that the Palestinian cause has now been defeated. I think it's far from it. I think UAE itself has shown that it depends on the greater civil society to rise up and change the dynamics of the region and of the world order itself regarding the Palestinian issue, in which justice should be brought and international law should be respected.
Now, talking about international law and the fact that we find a situation where more and more countries are recognizing the injustices, I would say, at least, but global superpowers, in a sense, the United sure. States and all the others, have had a stranglehold on the global agenda, in a sense, and as far as Israel and Palestine is concerned. So when we look at that, and I want to again revisit the UAE issue, because UAE is a very powerful player within the Arab world. You know, how does that affect the discussion on a global level in terms of the not only the Palestinian issue, but going forward the future of relations between Arabs and Jews in Palestine, when we see that there's a shift from Muslim countries, in a sense?
Well, I think, you know, there's a lot of things to unpack them. The first thing I would say that I don't believe the UAE is a very powerful player in the region. It is what I would say, and I think what you're trying to maybe say, is that they have been given a leverage by the superpowers to appear powerful. But UAE's position, internally, in its presence, leadership's hold to power, is not dependent on the legitimacy of the people on the ground in UAE. It's dependent on the fact that America and Europe is allowing to have that authoritarian regime. Once they turn around, UAE would collapse within weeks. So, you know, they're very, very weak. And in one way, the reason UAE had to accept and come publicly of its relationship with Israel is because it's a proxy power of America. It has to do what America, superpower, tells us to do. And at the moment, American administration is very pro-Israeli, extremist Zionist, I would say. And therefore, a lot of client states within the Middle East are feeling the heat to accept Israel as a normal state. And that is a problem. So I would shift that. The other fact is, I would try to understand that what UAE is doing is not for a point of strength, but weakness. Because if they were strong, then we would understand that they would be able to stand up for justice while America would be able to condemn it. But they cannot do that. They can't afford to do that. And that's why it has to do what it has done. And therefore, I think there's a polarization within the not only the political, the mainstream sort of leadership in the region, but between the population and its leadership. And I think that will come to haunt many of the states within the Middle East who think it is acceptable and normal to accept a racist state and its legitimacy while it's oppressing another people, whether they're Muslims or non-Muslims. The other factor you mentioned about Jewish-Muslim factor, I think it's very important to point out that the Jewish people have lived happily amongst Muslim population for hundreds of years, if not thousands. When the Jews were being persecuted throughout Europe, they found refuge in the Muslim world. So Muslims do not have any problems with the Jewish population at all. What they have a problem with is a Zionist political ideology that considers itself superior and wants to undermine and expel the indigenous people. That's where the problem emerges. And I think we have to be very clear about that point.
The voice of Ismail Patel, founder of Friends of Palestine. And Ismail, I just want to then get into one of the other issues here. And I think this one is particularly important for us to address because it speaks to the global movement. Now, BDS and the various BDS movements have been very effective in at least affecting some kind of economic shift in the thinking around Palestine. But if we look at how the BDS movement is viewed in the United States, for instance, there seems to be, at least at a political level, a lot of resistance to BDS movements. I believe at one point certain universities were actually, in a sense, prejudicing students who formed parts of BDS movements, and if there was any kind of activity on campus related to this, I believe they were penalized. So if you look at this, first of all, has the BDS movement, in your opinion, been effective as a tool? And do you feel it, in some ways it is under threat as a result of the threat that it poses from an economic point of view?
Well, I think it definitely is under threat. There's no doubt about it. But it's under threat because Israel itself is being threatened by the nonviolent movement and the civil rights of individuals throughout the globe. The fact of BDS as being nonviolent passive movement to bring about justice for the Palestinians, I think the Israelis are running out of excuses now. And they've had all the excuses to undermine the Palestinian cause. And this is the last straw for them. And therefore, they're putting out all their ammunition in the social media, financial, political, and diplomatic to undermine the BDS movement. Despite that, you look what's happened in America itself and in Europe. Let's take America where you started off. Despite what the administration is trying to do, there are many universities are still boycotting Israel. The Black Lives Movement now is now hand in glove with the Palestinian movement and calling for boycotting of the Palestinian, of the Israeli goods in the mainstream arena. That is a big shift change, irrespective of what the administration is doing. Similarly, think of Germany. In Germany, last year, I think it was a year before, they banned, nobody was allowed to do BDS. This year, they took the pro-Palestinian activists took the case to court, and the courts in Israel, in Germany have now said it's illegal to stop anybody boycotting Israel. Yeah, so we have a success. In Britain, the British government announced that no city councils in Britain could boycott Israeli goods. Leicester City Council took the British government to court and succeeded that, no, you can boycott goods coming out from West-occupied territories. So you have a battle going on. Before, Israel had an open arena, do what it likes. That is no longer possible. Yes, the BDS movement is in danger. Therefore, we have to be very vigilant, and we have to carry on not only exercising our right to boycott goods emerging from the occupied territories, but we have to fight for our civil liberties and our rights to boycott any nation we feel is transgressing human rights. And therefore, I think it's a very, very important tool, and I think it's very effective, and that is the reason Israel is so scared about BDS.
Now, besides looking at the significance of the burning of the minbar, we also unpack the normalization deal. We have been unpacking the normalization deal between Israel and the United Arab Emirates, which many Palestinian commentators and political voices have slammed. And now Hafiz Ibrahim Musa from the Palestine Information Network has written about this in his latest opinion piece, and we would like to unpack this with him a little bit more. He joins us online. Hafiz Ibrahim Musa, assalamu alaikum and welcome to the discussion.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, Muhammad Fasih, the fellow panelists as well as those joining us on this discussion all over the world.
Jazakallah khair, shukran so much. And yes, indeed, I think that first of all, we're speaking about 51 years later, the burning of the minbar, as a watershed moment and a key point in a downward trend. As far as the quality of life of Palestinians, you know, from annexation of land, from being persecuted, leaders being locked up, and so many different shifts. And I think hopefully, yeah, Ibrahim is still there. We'll just quickly address that. But in the meantime, basically, what I was trying to say is, if we look at that downward trend in a sense, and we look at where we are now as a community, we do have Ibrahim Musa still online with us. So viewing that through the lens of an ordinary you know citizen, but let's say for instance South African, we see now in social media this idea or this concept that the broader discussion around Palestine is a Jewish versus a Muslim issue. That is the issue being touted. And peace in the Middle East is seen as let's get these two religious groups together and let's find some common ground. And so when we see, countries like UAE, Muslim-dominated countries, come into the discussion extending a hand to Israel, it's seen as if that there is this support from a Muslim dominated country in this discussion, and so would you say the mainstream media view of this is in terms of its impact on the broader discussion, and what would you say the danger of misrepresenting this conflict as a Muslim and Jew, difference has on the issue of continuing to persecute Palestinians as we've seen over the number of years? Ibrahim?
We have to discuss here, what we have to point out here is that Israel has been living under, in a sense, borrowed time in its dealings with the world, in its not facing up to accountability for the occupation, through the years, particularly from the early 90s when this peace process started. You had the Madrid Peace Conference and you had the secret negotiations that culminated on the White House lawn with the signing of the Oslo Accords. And that was a game changer that really set back the Palestinians many, many years in their struggle for justice and equality. And, Israel was able to persist under this idea or the veneer that it is seeking peace with the Palestinians. And, that had continued through numerous peace conferences along the way, in Taba and in Indianapolis and many other places. But that obviously reached its logical end. It reached a stalemate. Even those who were previously partners with Israel in that peace process, although there's still security coordination, largely they've also given up on that particular process and recognized it to be a failure. Now, by at this particular time, for politically expedient reasons, with the figure of Donald Trump, being a mobilizing figure for Mohammed bin Zayed on the one hand, other Arab dictatorships, and Netanyahu on the other hand, they've used this to shore up their political careers, but they've also used this to create this cloud again, as if there's still a peace process going on. So Oslo reached its end, and when people started talking about annexation, Israel faced a firestorm across the world, with people even within former Zionists switching sides and saying that more and more people talking about the one-state solution. So Israel was facing a kind of PR nightmare there. And therefore, they've having lost on Oslo, they've come forward now with an alternative peace plan, ignoring the Palestinians completely, but saying, we're making peace with the wider world. And we need to call this out, saying that this conflict or this usurpation of land occurred on Palestinian land. It dispossessed Palestinians of their land, and therefore, speaking to any other Arab country, the experience of the peace treaty with Egypt, the Camp David Accords, supposedly said that it's going to have an impact on the fates of Palestinians. It didn't. And, for anybody actually to use the words, for the media to use the words, this is a peace deal, itself is very problematic. You only make peace with a country that you are at war at. And as many people have pointed out, your previous guests as well, these two countries have not been in a state of war. And more so since the early 90s, the UAE has been making overtures to the state of Israel. So that in itself is problematic. At the end of the day, this is more a security relationship between the United Arab Emirates and the state of Israel. And Israel itself has called bluff on this. If one has to see hours after these accords were released, Netanyahu said annexation is still on the table. And, more recent reports saying that we just said we wanted to suspend. The key word is suspend, whether it's suspend for a few days or a few weeks. But annexation was always on the table, and this does nothing to do that. So, just improving bilateral relations between the UAE and Israel in no way has any bearing on the material of what goes on the ground in the occupied territories.
Now, following on from Donald Trump's most recent comments the article that you had subsequently written around, the relationship with between UAE and Israel and normalizing of relations, one of the things that you mentioned was the weaponization of prayer. Could you maybe just expound on that choice of words?
Yes, Jazakallah khairan. What this is all about, and it goes back to those comments that Dr. Anwar Nagia referenced a bit earlier, and this came from Donald Trump itself. It's in the text of the deal, and it was emphasized after that by Jared Kushner as well. And this says that the agreement will allow for Muslims around the world to come and visit Masjid al-Aqsa in peace and pray at the Masjid. This is something that they haven't been able to do before. And the sentiments of Kushner were, he went into it in more detail than anybody else, that extremists, in his language, around the world have used Masjid al-Aqsa as a mobilizing force, saying that Muslims are not allowed to come to Masjid al-Aqsa, and the Masjid is out of bounds for Muslims, and therefore this will take the wind. I'm paraphrasing here, but this is the crux of his argument. This will take the wind out of the sails of these extremists. They won't be able to claim that Masjid al-Aqsa is under occupation anymore. Because people would be able to fly directly to Tel Aviv. Arabs who haven't been able to do this largely will be able to do that in droves and pray in peace in Masjid al-Aqsa. Now, I think there's still big question marks over Whether that will actually occur, yes. We've seen, progress towards establishment of embassies, telecommunication links, business links. Many things have moved quite fast. Netanyahu also spoke on Al Arabiya television in an interview, or Sky News Arabia, rather, so speaking directly to the Arab world. So there is progress for this normalization deal. But there's a big question mark about this, because the custodians of Masjid al-Aqsa, firstly, are on official level, the Jordanians. And more than the Jordanians, the bigger custodians are the people of Jerusalem. And we have a fatwa yesterday from Mufti Muhammad Hussein, the Mufti of Palestine, saying that anybody who visits Masjid al-Aqsa through the UAE-Israel deal is to be shunned, and this is a haram in his fatwa, a haram act. So whether they'll actually allow this to happen, whether there'll be, some resistance against this, remains to be seen. But the question you ask about weaponization of prayer is that even if this goes ahead, prayer at the holiest, third holiest site for Muslims should not be dependent. It's a universal right to pray at your holy sites, sites of universal heritage, UNESCO sites, etc. And one does not need this to be tied in towards a deal of capitulation for one to be able to pray there. One should be able to pray in dignity. And just as those worshippers refused to enter Masjid al-Aqsa because it would impinge their dignity going through the metal detectors of the oppressor, likewise, having to enter into Masjid al-Aqsa purely on the basis of recognizing Israel as the sovereign over Jerusalem and negating the Palestinians' rights is an absolute sellout. And I quoted in the piece a relevant quotation from Mulana Ihsan Hendricks, who spoke in 2014 about this, and probably on other occasions as well, where he referenced a certain person who came back, a Muslim from South Africa, who visited Al-Aqsa and said, I went there, I prayed, I enjoyed myself. To me, everything seemed above board. The Palestinians are not suffering, because, he had a sheltered view of a tourist. And Mona Ihsan Hendricks, forcefully interjected against that, saying, just because you are, as a foreign passport holder, have a great time in Palestine, and that because, you follow a certain tourist itinerary, does not mean that Masjid al-Aqsa is not under occupation and it doesn't face dire threats, etc. And therefore, the similar sentiment fits into this, that if people visit under this deal and see an embellished picture, just like people go on these fully paid junket visits from South Africa and elsewhere under Israeli auspices, and give all wonderful testimonies under Israel. It's a kind of sellout, and it's going against the grain of what Palestinians in Jerusalem themselves, who are the main players, feel about this.
Now, Dr. Anwar, if we look at what we've mentioned, and one thing that comes to mind is obviously, I think it was 2019 where the United States and Israel left, UNESCO. We also know that not too long ago, UNESCO admitted Palestine and recognized the Palestinian site of Masjid al-Aqsa. So when we look at that and would you say that the leaving of UNESCO, the fact that this idea around them feeling a sense of offense that the Hebrew name of the compound of Masjid al-Aqsa was never included as part of the reference to the site, that these also in a sense paved the way for a direction towards annexation?
That's one part of adding to the kind of legitimacy and the giving credence to the right-wing forces inside of occupied Palestine. I mean, within within the Israeli parliament. I mean, the contestations have been, they had three elections just to decide whether Gantz and Netanyahu can finally come to an agreement. It's probably the most contested space in the entire region in terms of what they would talk about, a democracy, which is a racist democracy. There's no democracy, there's a qualified vote, and so on and so on. But just in terms of your question, you know, you can't placate the debate premised on issues of race or issues of occupation and issues on UNESCO. The issues of UNESCO just further exacerbated the issues. I mean, America has also removed themselves from the climate change conference. They've removed themselves out of their own statute. They removed themselves out of, in fact, kind of protecting wherever they are, that, you know, the Rome Statute don't apply to them, and issues on human rights violations doesn't apply to them because they're kind of exonerated. Now, the issues around giving credence to the narrative that a Jewish state actually existed and that the Temple Mount is part of the Al-Aqsa compound or the Al-Aqsa complex, in fact, was further... they were further embarrassed by UNESCO not finding any traces. We know that about 14 attempts by Israeli archaeologists who were digging under the Al-Aqsa compound couldn't find any trace of Temple Mounts or Jewish civilization to an extent. But this has been conducted by a Zionist, informed by a Zionist position, not informed by a proper Jewish commitment to peace and establishment in the area. Now, what's happening presently is that the young millennials in Palestine, occupied Palestine, can't be sold this old narrative anymore. And they're not taking it. They, for the first time, you know, there was demonstrations day after day, night after night, against Netanyahu. There is obviously, in terms of the protection of Israel, a kind of threat that they sell to their populace, that, you know, Iran is going to bomb them, you know, Syria is going to bomb them, Lebanon is going to bomb them, Hamas, and of course the organization which is now part of the Lebanese government, I forget the...
Hezbollah,
you know, that they are always in danger, and therefore these countries must be unsettled, Iraq must be unsettled, and so on and so on. So the issues around the removing of any remnants of the Jewish narrative there was just for the first time a truthful position by UNESCO, a truthful position by the United Nations. Although about 124 resolutions have never ever been implemented, but yet they implement resolutions over no-fly zones in Libya, issues of no-fly zones in Iraq at the time. They even removed a satellite navigation off Iraq when they bombed Iraq at the time. So the inconsistencies by the United Nations, the inconsistencies on the Western media that are only spinning a particular narrative, and it takes organizations like ourselves, like the people all on this platform, to give people a sense of the real and the true story. And that's coming out. Now, the last thing I want to say, there's many Christians that are being persecuted. It's not a contestation between Islam and Judaism. It's not. It's a political contestation of occupation. It's a political occupation of a violent occupation, of seizure of land, identity, and of a people. And so too the Church of the Holy Sepulchre itself was under threat. And the Christian priests then refused to open the church because they were taxed. In other words, they had to sell parts of the church over to Zionist occupiers, exactly as they forced a Palestinian to sell a small little coffee shop, a tea shop, right next to the boundaries of the East Wall of the Al-Aqsa compound. the Al-Aqsa Mosque area. So this is all part of it. Then just lastly, the BDS movement, as you alluded to earlier, I was just listening to some of the replies. So the Israeli government spends about $3 billion, not a year, but $3 billion US dollars have been set aside. In South African terms, that's 60 billion rand to counter the BDS movement. So they're punching hugely above their weight, and court after court in a democratic process have in fact came up trumps for the BDS movement. And we have civil society behind us that are now not going to take the nonsense of the biased media in vilifying the BDS movement. In America, in Australia, in Germany, in Austria, parliamentarians are in fact batting for Israel against the acceptance of the BDS movement. And we're not going to go away. The BDS movement and its alliance partners just won't go away. So too is the new organization, Africa for Palestine, making huge, huge strides, like the BDS movement have done. And the Al-Quds Foundation in South Africa, and many movements, the PSG, the PSA, you know, National Coalition for Palestine. There is an assembly of movements that are mitigating against the issues of the Zionist narrative and the Israeli project as it is today.
Just in wrapping up the discussion this evening, Ibrahim, just from your perspective, we've seen a lot of activity over the last couple of years. Earlier on, we had a discussion where we spoke about the metal detectors and security measures that was attempted to be installed in the on the compound of Al-Aqsa, and this drew the fury of people. We eventually decided to perform Salah outside of the compound of Al-Aqsa until these security measures were removed. If we look at from the point of view of the experience of ordinary Palestinians, not just in terms of being monitored and being watched by the state, but let's look, for instance, just at the experiences of ordinary Palestinians, particularly, you know, when it comes to the Zionist counterparts, when it comes to, you know, radical Zionists and settlers and their attitudes towards Palestinians. How would you look at that sense of hostility as experienced by the Palestinians on a daily basis?
I think if we center this question, Mohammed Fasih, on Masjid al-Aqsa itself as a battleground, and as Ismail Adam Patel had mentioned earlier, this the Masjid being a metaphor as well for the wider conflict, or for the wider Palestinian struggle. You have, for instance, when Israel took over the Palestinian territories, it worked through the settler movement. So you'd have the Messianic settlers, starting off an outpost on a mountaintop. And the Israeli army or the Israeli authorities to the world would say, you know, this is just a bunch of fundamentalist settlers, and they don't have anything to do with our official policy. That's how they would convey it to the world. And thereafter, those settlers would be provided with armed Israeli protection. And that, small shack that they had set up, or container that they had set up, eventually becomes a house or two. And with time, it's formalized. And, you have these mega settlements that have come up all across the Palestinian territories. So that's kind of the modus operandi that Israel has used to increase settlements and apply sovereignty, and thereafter, come to the cusp of annexation of the West Bank. And likewise, this is the experience inside Masjid al-Aqsa, where, you know, you started off with Masjid al-Aqsa being, you know, in 1967, you know, purely a Muslim site. Thereafter, Israel took it over, and incremental steps. So it started straight after the occupation by taking over the Burak Wall of Masjid al-Aqsa and destroying the Maghariba neighborhood next to it. So integral part of Masjid al-Aqsa was thereby appropriated. Muslim access to Masjid al-Aqsa from the Maghariba gate was strictly barred from that time until now. It started off again with, if you have to take the burning incident, you know, people, Messianic Christian Zionists or Jewish Zionists, you know, they were portrayed as being the zealots who wanted to take over the site, and this had nothing to do with Israeli policy. But since the 2000s, we've seen that these zealots who were supposedly on the fringes of Israeli society are now in official sites of power. Some of them have come into the Knesset, some of them have come into the legislature, have come into you know, the legal organs of the state. And thereafter, you know, they've changed their approach to work through these institutions, and they've won over the Israeli security apparatus to their side, and they've started to increase in their visits to Masjid al-Aqsa, and they say once we reach a certain amount of visitors to Masjid al-Aqsa, ascending the Temple Mount, as they call it, we'd be able to reach a critical mass and change the sovereignty over Masjid al-Aqsa. So, and the Palestinians say that this is part of a plan to divide Masjid al-Aqsa in terms of time. So, you know, specific times for Muslims, specific times for Jewish worshippers, specific places as well. So division in terms of place, specific areas of Masjid al-Aqsa, the eastern area, Bab al-Rahma, convert that into a synagogue, and the rest of areas for Muslims, all parts of incremental steps to take over Masjid al-Aqsa. So what was once a supposedly a fringe movement in Israel after 1967, and those kind of attacks were carried out by fundamentalists or zealots, has become extremely mainstream, and now there's official temple lobby and members of parliament and members of ministers visit Masjid al-Aqsa and are part of this movement. And therefore, I think the wider point to be made towards this end of the discussion is that annexation and occupation, be it of Masjid al-Aqsa or the wider area of Palestine, is not an event. And therefore, you know, many fell into the trap to say that annexation didn't happen on the 1st of July, so it's not going to happen, or it's, you know, it's been delayed. No. It's a process. And likewise, Masjid al-Aqsa, as we see how it has developed from 1967-69 until now, you know, it's taking one small step at a time, keeping the bigger picture in mind. And what is that bigger picture? According to many Palestinians, and they've kind of attributed a statement that the late Mawlana Ihsan Hendricks used to mention quite often in the Arabic language, La ma'ana لإسرائيل بدون القدس ولا معنى بالقدس بدون الهيكل, that there's no meaning to Israel without Jerusalem, and there's no meaning to Jerusalem without the you know, the establishment of the temple. So through these incremental steps, it's coming to that direction, and therefore it requires a vigilant eye on Masjid al-Aqsa, and using such occasions such as the anniversary of the arson attack on Masjid al-Aqsa to once again refocus our attentions, our energies to the people of Jerusalem, to Masjid al-Aqsa, to the wider Palestinian struggle, and also once again reaffirm and intensify our responsibilities and actions in this direction.
Ibrahim Musa, Hafiz Ibrahim Musa, shukran so much for joining us from the Palestinian Information Network. We do appreciate your time on the show, and of course, inshallah, we will us continue to cover this issue of the burning of the minbar, but also I think to continue the discussions around Palestine as a whole. We need to maintain and keep this on the agenda at all times, because it's so easy in the malaise of social media and all of the other issues that pop up on our feed all the time to forget about the persecution of Palestinians and the annexation Jerusalem or Palestine, rather. I want to say big shukran to you. All the best, sir, and chat soon, inshallah. Amen. And then also to yourself, Mr. Nagia, shukran so much for joining us this evening and being our guest for the entire 2 hours. Alhamdulillah. All the best. Stay safe, inshallah. We'll chat soon.
Shukran to you and to listeners. Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From myself, Muhammad Fasif Peterson, it's been a pleasure being in your company. And once again, we want to say a big shukran to the listeners of CII Radio Islam and Salam Media for joining us this evening. And wa assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.